intend to be, now's the time to get off the bus. We'll go ahead and establish a quorum.
Roth?
Here.
Glazer? Wen? Pan?
Here.
We have a proposed vote-only agenda that has six items. Do any of my colleagues wish to have any items pulled from the vote-only calendar as opposed to separated out for purposes of vote? Seeing and hearing none, we'll take the vote-only calendar. Now, what I propose to do is to do the vote only as to items 0509, Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, 0840, State Controller's Office, 8880, Financial Information System for California, 0954, ScholarShare Investment Board, and 0959, California Debt Limit Allocation Committee. Those five items first. Is there a motion?
So moved.
It's been moved. Please call the roll.
Roth?
Aye.
Glazer? Wen?
Aye.
Pan?
Aye.
Let's next take item 0860, Board of Equalization, issue number one, Board of Equalization physical office space as a separate item. Is there a motion?
So moved.
It's been moved. Please call the roll.
Roth?
Aye.
Glazer? Wen?
Aye.
Pan?
Aye.
Thank you. Now let's move to the items for discussion and vote. The first item on page 10 of the agenda is item 8880, Financial Information System for California.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Miriam Barcelona-Ingenito, and I am the executive partner for the Financial Information System of California, the FSC, the Financial Services Center, as well as the project.
Sir?
Ted Ryan, Department of Finance. I'm the budget analyst for the Department for Fiscal and the Fiscal Service Center.
Thank you both for joining us. To my right, Elio.
Lourdes Morales with the Legislative Analyst Office.
Nick Schroeder, also with the LAO.
Mr. Schroeder, good to have you back. Okay, who wants to proceed? This is item 8880, Financial Information System for California, page 10.
So we were asked to come back with a more detailed view, come back to the committee to provide more information about the governance going forward and what we will have in our trailer bill. And so I provided to your staff this morning a two-page org chart. It's 2 pages here. Yeah, that document. And so I was just going to walk through that, and you can see that the two org charts are incredibly similar, but there are a couple of extra boxes on the second box. So first and foremost, the Department of Fiscal itself is replacing or renaming the Fiscal Service Center, and that the director would then have a chief deputy director and the directors under it, that we really retain and we would have all of the authorities of a true department, of a regular department, that it does not have a steering committee over that box, and the partner staff continue to be integrated underneath the deputy director box. So I have in the BCPs approximately 100 partner staff that we have interagency agreements with, and they're interagency agreements because they fluctuate depending on what the project is doing at any given point in time. I might need more SCO folks during part of the year and more DGS folks to help with the builder design or integration of something. So those partner staff do remain on staff. They do report up through the director. The functions of the department are admin, over facilities, over personnel, All of the system support and security belongs to the director, the service desk, the customer service, hardware upgrades, software upgrades, all of those primary decisions. Now, ultimately, the decision on when enhancements, defects, and workarounds are integrated into the schedule is also the responsibility of the director. So if you look at the second org chart, and this is how we're going to prioritize the defects, enhancements, and workarounds. So basically, at least once a year, the director will convene the four partners and the representative for the 154 departments. So each of the agency secretaries participate in what we call a customer impact committee, and they have a chair. And so that's the voice of the line departments, if you will. So that group of four and the chairperson of the CIC, along with the director of fiscal, sits down, prioritizes what are the needs of the system, you know, different lists for defect fixes versus enhancements. But at the end of the day, the director retains the responsibility and the authority to make changes to that and implement them in the order that best fits the system schedule, if you will, and the resources and the budget and all of the things that are happening in the system. We also have a prioritization structure that exists today that we will carry over and continue, in which we have, you know, at the very top of the list, the priority, if there's a health and safety issue that comes up. And folks think of a computer system, health and safety, they don't necessarily make that connection, but if there's a catastrophic fire or if there's an earthquake or something and people need a warrant out immediately or they need to do emergency purchases and there's a glitch in the system or something's not working, that moves to the very top of the list because health and safety has to come first. System security is, you know, at the top of that list as well. So, and they go down through the list. We have other prioritizations that also can come in kind of at any time that could trump the list, including a constitutional change by the voters that would impact one of the four requirements of the system or the partners in the system. And then, you know, statutory changes, if the legislature has, you know, passed a law that would require either one of the four partners, the Department of Fiscal itself, or any other department that is utilizing the system to provide additional information pertaining to financials or grants, we would have to make those changes, you know, a priority as well. So it's, you know, working in that close communication. The box that's to the left also exists today, and it's called the Operations Advisory Group. And it's when we get calls in the Fiscal Service Center from a department that says, okay, I have followed your directions. I have done A, B, C, you know, according to your guidance, your direction, your papers put out. I get all the way through the system, and somewhere along the way in the system, either at DGS or at the controller's office, something gets kicked back. They're giving contrary direction. And so we convene this group saying, okay, we have to all have one voice. It's a new system. There are glitches out there. And what has happened and has been very effective is that in the case, the most recent case, when this group came together, it was a disconnect between what was in SAM as it's written today versus SAM that needs to be updated. And so the update just needed to happen. So if you are a line department today, not in Fiscal, you continue to use it this way. And then if you are in Fiscal, you need to use it this other way. So this group is incredibly effective of getting resolution back out to the departments in a very quick basis, a quick turnaround. And those are more of the, how is the policy kind of being driven, the financial policy.
And it's advisory.
Right, and that's advisory coming back in.
Because one of the concerns, as I understand it, that was identified by the LAO, although we'll ask them to speak for themselves here in a second, is accountability, and there were some suggestions with respect to control agencies and making sure that the control agencies, such as the State Controller's Office, were more advisory as opposed to directive.
And, it, And so
that sounds as though that's what you're trying to get to with this.
With this box on the right here, yeah, that's really where they come in, and they will do a prioritization. It'll be a collective effort, and it, in my opinion, it has to be a collective effort. But at the end of the day,
it stops with you.
The director has to ultimately implement and make changes to the system, and I'm the only one that can.
LAO?
Yes, we appreciate that the project is taking steps to address some of the accountability issues that were raised by this committee as well as in our analysis. Our understanding is that the revisions to the trailer bill will formalize what was described today by the project, and so we agree with the staff recommendation to hold the trailer bill open until that language becomes available, at which time we'll review and have comments.
Based on what you heard, however, this morning, does this approach appear to address LAO's concerns with respect to accountability and the role of control agencies vis-a-vis the director of this new fiscal department?
Yes, it seems like a step in the right direction.
Okay, colleagues, any questions? Senator Lynn.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, is there a way that for the trailer bill, can we delay, to amend the bill language to delay the implementation date until January 1st, 2017 in order to be consistent with the intent of the state constitution?
Well, we don't know what the trailer bill language is yet, so that's exactly why I think we're holding it open to take a look at that. We'll obviously need to vote on this fairly quickly, but as soon as the trailer bill language is available, absolutely, and I think, I'd ask the soon-to-be department folks and Department of Finance to consult with your staff on whatever concerns you have.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Senator Pan.
So just a quick question in terms of, because you gave us this org chart for the executive branch, where would you propose you sit in this thing? So I see the org piece for your part. But where does that director sit relative, or fiscal sits relative to this?
So intent is that when the project is 100% complete and implemented, that it does go under GovOps.
GovOps, okay.
And in this kind of transition period that we find ourselves in right now, where I've got both departmental functions as well as project completion and implementation development design going on simultaneously, we're proposing to be... as we are now in the Fiscal Service Center, just a box existing in state government. There is in the state this entity. But because we're proposing that the governor be directed by, appointed by the governor and serve at the governor's pleasure, unlike these other floating boxes here that are term appointments, this is a pleasure appointment and would report directly into the governor's office.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions, colleagues?
Just a point of clarity, I'd like to point out that the proposal as it stands now does not specify that the department, if it's created, would be under GovOps or specify a date for when that transition would happen. So that hasn't been formalized.
And we will.
But you'll work on the language and get it back to us so we can take a look at it before we vote.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Anything else, colleagues? Public comment? Okay, we're going to hold this item open pending receipt of the trailer bill language. Look forward to voting on this in the very, very near future. Thank you for your presentation.
And thank you.
For your attention to the detail. Next item is 0981, California Achieving a Better Life Experience Act, Issue 1, Program Administration Costs. I will note for the record, the staff recommendation is to approve as proposed in budget bill language.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
That means you're winning.
Move it.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just teasing you.
I'm Grant Boykin, Deputy Treasurer for State Treasurer John Chung, here today to talk about the ABLE Act. So in 2015, the legislature passed the California ABLE Act. The governor signed it. And it establishes a board to create a savings program consistent with the Internal Revenue Code 529A savings plan. Allows families to save for people or family members who are disabled under the age of 26. We're here today to request $1.5 million over 2 years that would include three staff members, an executive director, a manager, and an analyst to staff the board, And it also allows for consultant to help with the initial procurement.
Good proposal. Finance.
I'm Nick Adair, Department of Finance. We have no concerns.
Great. LAO?
I'm Christine, LAO. We have no concerns.
Colleagues, questions? Seeing none, any public comment? The motion or the recommendation is to approve as proposed with budget bill language, so I would take a motion to that effect. It's been moved. Please call the roll.
Roth?
Aye.
Glazer?
Aye.
Wynn?
Aye.
Pan?
Aye.
Thank you, sir. Next item, 0968, California Tax Credit Allocation Committee. One issue, issue number one, modification of low-income housing tax credit. Trail of bill language.
Good morning.
Still morning. Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
If you'd identify yourselves for the record, starting to my left, your right, sir.
I am Matt Schwartz. I'm CEO of the California Housing Partnership.
Schwartz, thank you for joining us, ma'am.
I'm Lisa Vergolini. I'm the Deputy Director of the California Tax Credit Allocation Committee and in support for the State Treasurer for the bill.
It's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yes.
Finance.
Colby White, Department of Finance.
Jim Doyle, Department of Finance.
Thank you for joining us, LAO. Good to see you again.
Brian Euler, LAO.
Okay. Who wants to present?
So the proposal before you is, I like to think that California is always first in good ideas, but this proposal to allow the sale of an existing state tax credit separately from a partnership interest has already been used in 12 other states successfully. And essentially what it would do would be allow the, by allowing the credits to be sold by nonprofit general partners in limited partnerships outside of the partnership interest, it allows us to have a structure where federal taxes do not have to be paid on the sale of the state credit, which is otherwise roughly a 35% penalty that the state is paying on its investment. So this would allow us to boost the yield to affordable housing developments, as well as a benefit to the state of California from about 65 to 70 cents on the dollar to upwards of 90 cents on the dollar, because this low-income housing tax credit program is already a very efficient program, except for this federal tax problem that we're facing. So that's the simplest description.
Now, there's some restrictions on the purchasers and the sellers, correct?
That is correct.
Which is pretty significant. This is not, we're simply not selling things to people who want to avoid taxes. There's some.
No, thank you,
for. Can you go into that for us?
Yes, I will to the best of my ability, and my colleague, Lisa Vergolini, will probably add to that. But it's we've worked with staff and, of course, the author's office to make sure that the purchasers would be limited to those purchasers who are already purchasing low-income housing tax credits in California. Those are typically large corporations, large banks, large institutions like Southern California Edison, Chevron. These are major players. These are not mom-and-pop purchasers of a state credit. So it's going to be a sophisticated market. The market already exists. It already works very fluidly, and I think this is a good precaution that you just pointed out, Senator Roth.
And how does that result in low-income housing?
Well, the way it results in low-income housing is private developers approach Ms. Vergolini's agency, and they have a plan to build, let's say, 100-unit apartment development in Sacramento, and the request is for tax credits that will essentially buy down market rate rents, which might otherwise be $2,000 or $3,000 a month, to a level where they could be affordable to a family at 50% of median, or roughly half the median income. And Ms. Vergolini's agency does careful underwriting to make sure that the development proposal is well thought out, that it's financially feasible, that it follows current underwriting practices. There's a market study that's done. Mm-hmm. And if all those boxes are checked, then the developer will eventually receive the state tax credits and turns around and puts them on the market to be competed for by those large corporations I described earlier, the major banks typically.
So it results in the construction of additional low-income housing?
It does. It does, because the banks and investors will then pay the money for those credits, and that goes right to the developer, who it closes the financial feasibility gap and allows those apartments to be built in such a way that they're actually affordable.
Okay. Well said.
Finance, any comment?
We don't have a position on this issue at this time. However, we just note that it does result in revenue losses beginning in 17-18 and rising to as much as $2 million by 2021. So we're just noting that for the record.
The total is a $2 million revenue loss to the general fund budget?
By 2021 as estimated by the Franchise Tax Board.
Okay. So just $2 million. LAO?
We don't have any concerns with this proposal, but would also just note on a little bit of nuance to the FTB's estimates of the financial effects is that they're actually stating that these fiscal effects are essentially an acceleration of the claiming of the credit. So in effect, if you think over the very long term, the net effect on the general fund is not actually the $2 million per year. They're actually discussing essentially that the credits might be claimed a little bit sooner than they otherwise would have because they're able to be sold.
So the net effect is lower?
Likely, yeah.
Okay. And for the record, we don't particularly agree with that there is this time period where they don't claim the credits currently. So we don't think that lag is really happening, but we haven't seen their data, the Franchise Tax Board data on that.
And I can add that California Housing Partnership actually helps sell these tax credits statewide. We help develop the schedule upon which the credits are claimed. And we'd really like to see the underlying data that the FTB is using because these credits are fully subscribed, they're on a set schedule, and they're already being fully used at the fastest rate possible. So I respectfully disagree with whatever assumptions went into that without seeing more information.
But again, we're used to talking in terms of billions here. It's $2 million as opposed to $2 billion. Potential impact, if that, on the general fund. Colleagues, any questions? Senator Glazer.
Good morning. Is there any way to codify the actual units that would be provided based on this language change?
I can attempt to give you a back-of-the-envelope estimate. This change would boost the value of the existing state tax credit. It's roughly $95 million a year in existing state tax credits. So that increase, if the Assembly budget proposals to increase that amount do not move forward, let's just assume it's roughly $100 million, we could be increasing the value up to $130-140 million. In terms of actual apartments produced, the rough amount of state credits that would be needed, leveraged by federal credits, so it's a little bit difficult, but I would say it's probably on average about $30,000 a unit of state credit and another $90,000 potentially of federal credit that's going to be matched by that. So let's see, where does that math get us? We're talking about roughly a $40 million, let's call it a $30 million increase, $30,000. So we could be looking at another 1,000 low-income apartments produced. And I would just add, but for this dispute with the FTB, essentially no real cost to the state.
That's what I wanted to try to understand, given the differences on the costs. At least I think it's always good to get out of the obscurity of some of those language choices and get it into something that's real, and appreciate you trying to do that here. And I think it'd benefit if that was in the analysis going forward, that we could try to make it clear what the benefits are to actual people. Thank you.
Certainly, because at some point there may be a tug. It goes on in the budget process, and if folks are interested in keeping this in the final version of whatever budget is that we come up with, both here and what ultimately results, we ought to have the impact on our affordable housing crisis, and be able to compare that in some realistic way to the cost of the general fund budget. I am impressed by the fact that it's at best a $2 million hit to 120 $3 or so billion dollar general fund budget. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
just to follow up with that, and if you look at some of the analysis of some of the other worthy programs, and I certainly think this is one, the budget costs are much more substantial, I think, given the top of the envelope analysis. But I think exactly to your point, whether it's the mentally ill housing program or some of the others, it'd be good to be as clear as we can to the beneficiaries that they would provide.
Colleagues, any other questions? Senator Pan?
Thank you. So what I do hear is, admittedly, the money's small, but what would be the mechanism by which the state would lose general fund revenue? That was never clear to me.
So. It really just is an acceleration of credit usage. So credits that would have been used a little slower under the current law would be used a bit faster.
So actually what you're saying is that loss in general fund revenue would have been lost anyway, just maybe in a different year than it would have been used? I mean, I'm just trying to clarify.
It's an acceleration. So the revenues that would have been lost in a future year will be lost in a more recent year.
Okay, so other than the potential time cost of money, the interest, I don't know whether we spend the money or budget, but so really isn't that. I mean, so when you say $2 million loss in 2021, you're really talking about $2 million that might have been spent, instead of being spent in 2021, would be spent in 2022 or something of that nature? Is that what?
Yeah, I don't know what future year it would have fallen in under FTB's assumptions, but revenue's $2 million lower according to FTB in 2021, presumably, and then in a later year that revenue would have shown up.
So do you count for the, when you do this, and again, I won't belabor it because it's not that much money in terms of, I mean, it's a lot of money from an individual standpoint, from in terms of our budget. So when someone says we're going to lose X, however many, 2 million or 700 that year, and we're calculating the subsequent year, I mean, now that we use the credit already, we don't lose that money the subsequent year. So is that always a net for the fact that it's a future year and we give back the credit? I mean, so I'm just trying to understand, because you're saying, like, in this, at least in my staff analysis, you know, the first year you got 100,000, next year it builds up to 2 million, but is that 2 million take account of the fact that you had people already claiming some of what would have been claimed that year earlier? I mean,
Yes, the 2 million stands on its own. That would be net of all those.
A net. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Okay. Colleagues, anything further? Any public comment on this? You see there's no particular staff recommendation. Colleagues, what's your preference?
Excuse me, Chair. One public comment in support.
I'm sorry.
Derek Thomas with Sloat Higgins Jensen and Associates on behalf of the California Housing Consortium. We think this proposal is good for affordable housing construction in California, and agree with the staff recommendation to approve the trailer bill language placeholder. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Senator Nguyen, move to approve. It's been moved. Please call the roll.
Roth?
Aye.
Glazer?
Aye.
Nguyen?
Aye.
Pan?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next item is 0950, State Treasurer's Office Issue 1, Debt Management System. I will note for the record that the staff recommendation is to approve as proposed. So this may be short.
Good afternoon, Chairman Roth and committee members. And it is officially afternoon.
So this is what you use to manage bonds and refinancing and the rest of that. Have I got this right?
Yes.
Okay. And what you need is a system to do that.
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything else that I've missed on this that you can add?
No, you haven't. I was hoping just to give you an update as to where we're today.
You can certainly do that.
And it'll be very fast.
Good.
My name is Kumar Salam.
You don't want to lose.
My name is Kumar Salam. I'm the Deputy Chief Information Officer for the State Treasurer's Office. And
good afternoon. I'm Blake Fowler with the Public Finance Division.
So what I wanted to just, as part of our regular updates to you, we're on target as to our planned milestones on this project, as to the project schedule and the implementation approach that we had previously shared with this committee. We just got our project vendor hired, and we're going to begin working with that vendor as to carve out an overarching plan and the work products we'll do and the order in which we'll do them and by when we'll do them. So just wanted to give you an update. We're on target. We are we're exactly where we need to be.
And I bet if you have metrics in place, I bet when this is all implemented, you'll be able to show us how much money you've saved, if I understand how this process works, save the state through the operation of the system, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Perfect. Finance.
We have no concerns.
LAO.
We have no concerns.
Colleagues, any questions?
Move the bill.
It's been moved. Any public comment? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Roth?
Aye.
Glazer?
Aye.
Wynn? Pan?
Aye.
There you go.
Okay.
Thank you very much. You want me to hold it? Okay. Control section 6.10, issue 1, funding for deferred maintenance projects. This is budget bill language that I believe is still under construction, but good afternoon.
Afternoon, yes. Good afternoon, Sally Lucanville, Department of Finance. The agenda does a nice job of summarizing the administration's deferred maintenance proposal, so I won't restate any of the details on that today. The agenda does include two recommendations that I'd like to comment on briefly. The first recommendation is that the final list of deferred maintenance projects be listed in the supplemental report of the 2016 Budget Act. We believe this is unnecessary, as the current process includes the reporting for project lists through a JLBC notification and a 30-day review period. For the 2015-16 deferred maintenance project lists, this notification was sent out immediately after budget enactment on July 2nd, and we expect to be able to provide notification within that same time frame this year so that the projects can move forward expeditiously. The second recommendation is to eliminate the current process for reporting changes to the final deferred maintenance list, which currently is through a quarterly notification to the JLBC, and the recommendation is to instead provide notification to the JLBC as changes occur with a 30-day review period. We have some concerns with this as well. First, the number of separate notifications that could potentially be sent and the workload involved could be substantial. As we've stated previously, we have currently over 1,100 projects proposed for deferred maintenance funding for 2016-17, not including Department of Water Resources. And given the number of projects, the number of new departments that are included in this control section, the number of notifications could be substantial. Second, we're also concerned that the 30-day review period could cause delays to some of these projects, particularly if we're unable to send the JLBC notification out right away. If, for example, if they're bundled into one letter, then some of those projects may have to wait substantially more than the 30-day review period. So we continue to support the administration's proposal as currently structured. However, we continue to evaluate the recommendations that are made in the agenda, and we'll continue to work with staff to determine the best way to address the legislature's concerns.
I think our concern is, as a legislature, at least this subcommittee's concern, is that we retain some oversight over what's going on, and that we know in advance, whatever that time frame is, as opposed to after the fact, when changes to the projects occur. And I would suspect that given the amount of money that we're talking about, even at the small level, $2 million, you're going to know about the changes ahead of time, and there's a timeline and a process for this. And so that's our concern, that we do stay in the game a little bit and that we participate with the administration as these projects move down the road and as changes occur, that we're at least notified. 30 days seems like a reasonable period of time. So it's my understanding that you all are continuing to work with staff. I think we're going to hold this open one more time, and we'll vote on it fairly soon, but work on the language a little bit to make sure that everybody's comfortable, given my interest in and my colleagues' interest in remaining involved in this. We don't want to put a burden on the administration or the agencies or departments. These are overdue. Some of this deferred maintenance long overdue. We want to make sure that it gets done and done in an efficient and effective way, while we still stay engaged. But having said that, colleagues, any questions? Yes, Senator Glazer? Senator Pan, who wants to go first? Flip a coin.
Seniority.
Boy. So this is an issue that's come up. I know the LAO's commented on the lack of legislative oversight over prioritization, so forth. And, you know, frankly, as a legislator, and I represent Sacramento, the capital region, I recognize there's a lot of deferred maintenance, and I'm sure you're going to have things like changing carpets, painting walls, stuff like that. But the challenge is that when we're not in the loop, I mean, I hear from my constituents about things that need to get fixed. I know we're behind on deferred maintenance. I represent Sac State. There's a lot of very old buildings there, and I go on tours and I see that. I see state buildings. I was on faculty at UC Davis. There's a lot of old, and so what happens is that they turn to me and say, you know, we've shown you this. What can you do? And I think we need to work more in partnership. And so I think it is important that we know what's going on, how the prioritization's made. So I realize that sometimes people say, well, boy, it's a hassle to let you know and so forth. But it's a problem. We're accountable. And so someone says, why isn't this fixed yet? And I go, well, the administration hasn't decided to fix that yet because we have this list this long. That's not an adequate answer. Right? So we need to be part of that discussion. And so, you know, what I have here is a list of numbers. And actually, interesting enough, the biggest one, DWR, there isn't even a list, I guess. And so, you know, the taxpayers know what their elected representatives are doing about it and what and expect us to weigh in. And so we've, you know, every time, and this is my second year on the subcommittee, we could come back and we have this, I see the same LAO report each time, and I hear from my constituents. And, you know, I understand, you know, the governor's office has, they're trying to figure this out too. And but people don't sit there and go, well, you know, we're one state government, and they expect that state government to work for them. So I hope that we can look at this as being something as a partnership. And I certainly hope that I get more information about both what's being done in my district maintenance-wise, and in addition, when can I expect to get things fixed? You know, what's that prioritization list? What's my say on it in terms of saying if something really, I mean, is problematic, that it's going to move up on that list instead of simply voting the money and then disappears? You know, I just don't know. So we've got to come up with a better way. And certainly I know the LAO suggested some suggestions on that. So I hope we can move more in that direction.
Senator Glazer.
I certainly would add on to what my colleague has said, I'd also thank the administration for taking the lead and not only identifying but in funding things that have been hanging around a long time. I don't know if I was here for the original hearing on this item, but so part of my inquiry here is a question, but what we are not seeing here is the extent of the problem. You know, this is a good effort, and while we would like to know more about how exactly the money would be spent, and that those are all important, what we don't see here is, how big is the problem, is it? And why shouldn't we be doing more? And this leads to my question, and maybe it's a question to staff, which is that while I know that these individually get examined within the subcommittee process of budget, when, if any, is there an opportunity to talk about this bigger issue of the extent of the problem that still exists and whether or not it's a priority of the Senate to do more here than maybe in other places of the budget? How is that handled? And I can ask as the freshman, I can ask the naive question.
Well, we can certainly figure out a time to have a hearing of this budget subcommittee on the overall deferred maintenance issue and the plan for deferred maintenance. I know the LAO has issued a report on that, and I'm sure the administration, Department of Finance would be willing to come back and just have a general conversation and discussion with us and with you all about what the nature and extent of the problem is and how it is we plan to address it, not only in the short term with items like these, but in the longer term, if that's of interest.
It is of interest to me to not only understand the broader context of the problem, but what is the plan. So I applaud this effort to fund these. Given my limited knowledge, I know that it's only touching the surface of some very deep and serious maintenance backlogs that exist out there. And I would be interested in knowing the administration's plan going forward, as well as ours, in terms of what would we like to see in out years, and then finally how it fits into the overall budget choices that we have to make.
We'll go ahead and try to get that on the schedule sometime. I don't know exactly when or how that's going to fit in with the regular budget process and our other legislative issues this year. But between now and the start of next session, we'll certainly get that on the schedule. Senator Pan.
Just to follow up with on Senator Glazier's suggestions. I mean, so we could have a hearing, and we've had reports from LAO, but one of the things that might also be helpful in realizing that the analyses have to be brief, but is you have one column with how much is being allocated for the year, different branches and so forth. And I realize that there may be some interpretational issues, but it'd be great if next to it was a column of what's the total of deferred that we, in other words, you see we're paying $64,000 for state hospitals. That's out of what is, you compiled the list, what is the total? I mean, that's $64 million out of your out $250 million, right? That you know, so that what happens is you get a sense of what the now I'll you know I've served on you know board of a you know a owners association for property, right, you know, HOA, stuff like that, and they often do you know studies where they look also over time, so you know deferred maintenance studies, so you say okay, this year we expect now you don't know when something may break or whatever, but you can kind of have some estimation, like, you know, air conditioning system will last X number of years, and you actually plan out for 5, 10, sometimes 20 years on the board of the medical side, we had a building, you know, plan it out and say, okay, we need to accumulate this much over time to deal with maintenance, right? We anticipate that you're going to have to replace the roof after so many years. People do these studies, and I'm sure people have looked at different buildings and so forth. You could even, I mean, at least one simple thing would say, what's the current deferred maintenance? I probably won't ask, because can we have a grid that actually says maintenance for this year and out for another 5 years or 10 years, and what do we expect is going to come up if you went on a normal maintenance schedule? Because that is something that actually owners of property do when you have large pieces of property, which certainly the state does. So you know what, and if you see that you're only doing a portion and you're falling behind, you might say, okay. I mean, that's when you raise your HOA dues. That's when you put aside more, et cetera, if you want to try to keep up. It's so in terms of planning purposes, we can have a hearing, and hearings are great, and we'll get more into detail in a hearing and about those specific issues, but also just on an ongoing basis in terms of how you report, it'd be good to say, this is what's being proposed in the budget, and this is what, here's the grid. Next to that line, how much we calculate actually the total amount is. So are we, is it the same that we're proposing? Is it 30% of that? Is it 10%? We don't have that context. Obviously, it isn't, you know, one fixed number.
So what we'll do is we'll try to schedule a meeting of this budget subcommittee, mm-hmm. particularly since you all are relatively local, mm-hmm. In the fall. Okay. In preparation for that, we'll ask, we'll obviously have the LAO's report, and we'll get some assistance from LAO, and perhaps finance and the administration could assist us in compiling some information ahead of time, and then we can just have a just a general discussion on deferred maintenance. So some of my colleagues have the opportunity to ask some questions, and we can figure out whether the information we receive as a budget subcommittee and budget staff receives is sufficient, or whether it would be helpful, and whether to get more information, and whether more information is available and convenient to provide. Does that make sense?
Yes, we'd be happy to assist in that effort.
Okay. So let's go ahead and do that. But I think what we're going to do is you all are still making tweaks to the control language, and we need to resolve a couple of the issues as to 30 days or whatever. So we'll let you all continue to work with staff on that, and then we'll bring it back at our, hopefully our next substantive meeting of Budget Subcommittee for. Thank you for continuing to work with us on that. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
LAO, did you have anything you wanted to add? I didn't mean to cut you out.
No problem. Helen Kirstein with the LAO. I think you largely covered a lot of the things we had in our comments. We do want to note that the administration did provide a draft list of projects on April 29th. I don't believe that the list had been available when the subcommittee first heard the agenda item. We had just a couple quick comments on that. There were quite a few projects, over 1,000 projects, as Ms. Lucanville mentioned, and there some of them were very, very costly projects. They ranged up to $55 million, so a wide variety of projects, some of which were very large. And it's difficult, I think, to evaluate the projects based on the information that's in those lists. And so I think one of the challenges the legislature will have is, especially with only a few weeks left in the remaining time before the budget's adopted, it's just really how you'll want to look at those lists, given the information that's available and given the number of projects. So you could focus on the largest projects or those that may jump out as ones that might not be either typically deferred maintenance or ones that might be lower priority. So you'll probably want to think about how you might focus your attention in the remaining few weeks. And then I just wanted to provide a couple of thoughts very quickly on the process. We have recommended, consistent with the staff recommendation, that once the legislature is comfortable with those projects, that those be memorialized in the supplemental report. We think it's important for the legislature to know what it's funding when it provides the funds. And then should there be changes, we think it's definitely reasonable that the administration come forward with a 30-day notification to the legislature in advance of making changes. We think that's definitely not an undue burden, and we think it's important for the legislature to have that opportunity to weigh in. We certainly wouldn't want the situation where some of those changes were not things that the legislature was comfortable with, but, you know, if it's after the fact and we're getting the notification, it's very difficult for the legislature to take action. So we think it's very important to have that notice. And definitely very interested in participating in any hearing or any further discussions. We think this is a very important issue, and we think, as the committee has mentioned, that really those long-term plans for how do we address this backlog, how do we make sure we understand what the backlog is, because in some ways it's kind of a moving target, and then really understanding from the administration what its plans are to address the backlog and to make sure it doesn't develop again, because we don't want to be funding every year deferred maintenance backlogs. We really should figure out a way to have better practices in place so these backlogs don't develop.
You know, I should note that it's my understanding anyway that while we deal with, you know, the control language in the list, right, the individual projects are being heard by budget subcommittees that deal with the specific issues. So the education budget sub would deal with the education projects. I believe we've already heard at least one military department project in here as part of the list that's set forth here. So the other budget subs will hear those projects that relate to them, and we'll hear the ones that relate to state administration. Anything further? Any public comment on this? Thank you for your comments, all of you. We will hold this item open. Is there anything further to come before this budget subcommittee?
If,
oh, open the roll. Open the roll on the vote-only items.
The first item was the first five issues under vote-only. Chair voting aye, Glazer.
Aye.
And the next one is Board of Equalization. Chair voting aye, Glazer.
Aye.
Now we are adjourned. A record. Thank you.